All right. Well, tonight, my wife is with me again, so hopefully you get a chance to get to know Becky a little bit. Got a couple of pictures again just of our family. My wife is a funny person. I am not. So a lot of pictures, whenever we're having a baby, she liked to say that there was a taco in my belly and a baby in hers, but really the taco is probably in her belly too. But we've got four kids. You're going to see two of them running around, playing, having a good time. And these are some old pictures, but we lived at Hume Lake. I mean, our kids were Hume Lake kids. It's funny to watch them. We've been gone a year, and to watch them come back, and our two oldest are just, boom, right into it. And then the two younger are trying to figure out how they know this place, which the six-year-old were like, you lived here for 5 years. Like, how do you, like, not understand that this is your home? But they're great kids. They like to do fun things. One thought that he was a fox for a long time. Now he thinks he's Kylo Ren from Star Wars, so we're dealing with that. And then Carmel, who's our baby, she's three now. It's funny how time flies and they get older quicker. She was telling me a great story as I was walking over here about all her friends who are here. So apparently she's made a lot of friends since we got up here. But we're excited to be back at Hume. And I mean, again, for 15 years, this was Becky and my home. And then for 10 years, I was the Joshua director, and I loved every minute of that. It's just a lot of fun raising kids at Hume Lake. And now we live in what we call the real world. We're like telling our kids, you can't just go walk around, off wherever you want. A stranger might take you. To our kids, there's no such thing as strangers. They're all camp people. We're like, no, that's not how the world works. So we're trying to help them learn these things. And the harder part is trying to teach them that they can't just go to the bathroom wherever they want. Because here at Hume, they would just go what they called mountain potty. And now that we live in a city, we're like, you can't do that without getting arrested. So all the fun things that you train them on. My son and I were having a conversation a couple days ago, and I was telling a story, and he likes it when I tell stories. So he's like, Dad, are you going to tell stories to the people? And I go, yeah, I think I'll tell him some stories. So I'm going to try each night to tell you a fun Hume story of my recollections of things. So this particular one happened about 12, 13 years ago. I was running the Wildwood camp at the time, and we were trying to do fun things with Wildwood students that all the rest of the students in the rest of the camps didn't get to do, because they were at Wildwoods, a little bit different than Ponderosa camp. So at the very end of the week, what we were doing is we were bringing them down on Friday nights, and we'd bring them down here, and they would get on boats at like 10 o'clock at night, and they would canoe the lake under the stars. I mean, what a cool thing to be able to do. So in order to make this work, it required a couple staff members to come down early and then go down towards the campground side and take some big lanterns and hang them up in trees so that the kids knew where to like canoe towards. And we would take turns being in charge of that job. And so this one particular night, it was one of my staff members. His name was John and I. And we head out there early. And I always love these moments, hanging out with one of your staff guys, just having a conversation about life and how things are going. We get the canoe lantern set up. And we can see the canoes way off in the distance as the staff have little headlamps on. And they're getting ready to bring the kids across. And as we sit there, we begin to hear this noise in the bushes. And It's some people, maybe five or six people, and they come down and we just hear this. Are we gonna do it? Yeah, let's do this. We got it. All right, take off your clothes. It's like a bunch of people gonna jump into the lake naked or something. And so I'm sitting there with my guy who works for me going, in about 10 minutes, 100 high school students are gonna land boats like D-Day right here. So I yell through the bushes, I'm all, hey, naked people. And they're like, well, someone's over there. I'm all, yes. There's someone over here. Just so you know, there are about 100 students making their way your direction. You think he's lying? I'm not lying. Listen. So they get real quiet and they hear like some like paddling. I'm all, that's them and they're coming and they will be here soon. I would appreciate it if you would go somewhere else. They nicely got their clothes on and took off before the students got there. We thought we had dodged the night of any more incidents. So we're sitting there, students come, we're doing our HPI ceremony thing that we did on the lake that night. We've been doing it all year, so we're pretty good at doing it. Then all of a sudden, like God has this awesome moment where a lightning storm starts. And lightning storms are awesome. They're fun to watch, except for when you're sitting there and going, all right, I've got 100 students, 20-some of them are in canoes, and the rest of them are in metal rowboats. You know, so we're watching it. We're still a good distance away. We're making things go quicker to get done faster. Finally, we're like, okay, we got to get them out of here because they don't row boats fast and it takes some time to get back. We're like, all right, everybody, get into the canoes, get into your boats. We're going to make our way back. And this girl comes up and she's extremely concerned to me. And she's like, I can't get in the boat. I can't get in the boat. I'm like, well, why not? And she's like, the lightning. And I'm all, yeah, it's no problem. She's all, but what about my braces? And I look back at her and I'm like, you'll be fine. But in my head, I'm like, don't worry about your braces. Be worrying about the metal boat that you're sitting in as you're making your way back across the lake. So all the good fun that happens while doing ministry, and hopefully we'll have some other great stories. As I get started this morning, or morning, it's evening now, I thought I would just show you, again, for me, a passion is the land. And the first time I went to Israel, Becky sent me off, it was like 11 or 12 years ago, and I came back changed. You know, you can go to seminary, you can go to Bible school, you can do all these things, but all of a sudden I was sitting on top of one of the hillsides overlooking the Galilee, and I'm just sitting there going, it's real. I always knew it was real, but like in that moment, it just connected. And I came back and Becky's like, you're different. And I'm like, I know. And then she's like, what are you gonna do about it? I'm like, I gotta figure out a way to go back to Israel as much as I can. And that's when I told Hume Lake I was gonna take the Joshua program every single year. And they're like, okay. So we started going to Israel, but I wanted to give you a little glimpse of the land. I'm gonna use a Joshua video that shows the trip to Israel to do that. And then we'll jump in today's talk. So Luke, cue us up.
Where the stories took place that we read in the Bible. And it's just been such an amazing experience just to see everything that Jesus, where Jesus walked and where God led his people.
God just really met me where I was and where I am at here in his holy place. And as I go home, I'm just going to rely on the fact that I need to trust in God, that he's opened my eyes to pictures in the Bible that gets talked about. And I'm now going to have images in my heart to just rely on. And I want to read his word.
It's been really encouraging not only to see where Jesus walked, but where his apostles walked, and to see what the men did that lived their whole lives for Christ and sharing his word. So I've been really encouraged just to not make sharing the gospel a part of my life, but my whole life, the way that his apostles did and the way that he did.
I think the most impactful thing for me this trip has just been walking the land and just feeling what the rocks feel like under my feet, the same soil and ground that people in the just all through New Testament would have walked on, and being in the desert and seeing what the Israelites stayed in for 40 years, and just being in this land and being able to hear the sounds and the smells and just the sights has been something that I think will change my reading the Bible for the rest of my life.
The fact that this is real, you know, that everything that has been taking place in the Bible is real, and that the life that we live is real, and that God is moving. Here we are, and you can just see the dome on the rock, and just right to the west of it, the Western Wall, and people just, you know, desperately seeking for God and seeking to touch him and to be close to him. And the truth is that God is living within us, and that God is here and God is active. That would be the biggest takeaway for me.
closer to your heart. Take me, lift me up to where you are. I wanna see your face to face, in the light of your mercy, in the arms of your grace. My heart
When you read the Bible at home, you read it black and white. And when you come to Israel, you got the colors.
Man, I feel like we need to go. During my time at Joshua, I had the opportunity to take over 550 college students to Israel. And what an amazing time that was. And then started taking adults, and now I work for a company, and that's all I do full time. So it's kind of a cool job. So there'll be an airplane waiting for us in just a few minutes. We'll be back in time to pick up your kids later, things like that. When I set it up this morning, I said we're going to be teaching Jesus in his context this week. That's true, but I'm going to go off of that just a little bit because I got to set you up for the rest of our talks. We're going to be doing Jesus stories the entire time, except for tonight. I want to get you ready for the fact that context, geography, culture matters. And it's assumed as readers that we understand it. And that's the hard thing with the Bible sometimes. It was written to a different people group at a different time. And so as we come into it, we've got to do a little bit of extra work to sometimes understand things that naturally came to the reader at the time that it was written to. So we're going to kind of jump into that a little bit. But I always tell people when I'm teaching classes or taking people to Israel that geography is a flavor. And I know there are a few of you out there who are probably coffee snobs. Any coffee snobs? Just raise your hand, because coffee snobs always raise their hand. Right on. Right on. See, coffee snobs, I'm not one of them. I just drink whatever's put in front of me. But coffee snobs, my friends who are coffee snobs, they will tell me, they'll be like, Rich, coffee matters where it's grown. It matters the climate that it was. They go into this entire spiel on coffee and how the location of the coffee matters to the aroma, the taste, all of these things. And I began to understand, talking to my coffee snob friends, that's a lot how context of anything is. Especially with the Bible, it matters where the Bible was written. It matters the culture it was written in. So just like your favorite beans that are out there and that you care about them because they were grown in a certain place, because that changes the coffee, the Bible is what it is today because of where it developed inside of. It developed inside of a Middle Eastern culture, first century with Jesus. Old Testament's going to be further back with that. But that's what developed the cultures and the pieces that were there within inside of Judaism is what you and I have today. And so we have to do a little bit of work to get there and to be able to understand it. So the land of Israel, I call it the fifth gospel. So we got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the land of the Bible. And when we add the land of the Bible to our gospels, it brings it alive. So I don't think there's going to be anything, and this might be you going, I'm not coming back after I make this statement. I don't think there's anything new I'm going to teach you that you haven't heard before. But what I'm going to do is hopefully bring some more flavor to what you know and to bring up the culture and some of the other pieces to where you go, wow, that story that I've always heard, that teaching of Jesus, that makes a little bit more sense inside of that cultural experience. Hopefully with Caesarea Philippi this morning that you were able to sense that. And if come with me to Israel sometime and I'll give you the real talk. That was the PG version. It's fun to make people uncomfortable with the rest of it. So come with me and I'll make you uncomfortable. But here we go. When you go to Israel, when you go to anywhere such as that, Luke, it skipped on me. There we go. When you go to any culture, you got to experience the culture. And anybody who's had a chance to travel anywhere, you know that that's half the fun of the trip. Half the fun of the trip is trying food that you're not used to. Half the fun of the trip is trying to figure out how to blend in. Half the fun of the trip is experiencing what other people know as normal and you coming into that. And so when we go on these trips to Israel, we want people to understand what it tastes like. We want them to understand what it looks like. We want them to understand what it feels like. And we bring them into this land. And that's why I love Israel, because it's going to bring your Bible alive inside of that. And so as you're walking through the souk or through the markets, you're getting a chance to step back in time to a place where, you know, our Bible is set in that time period. And so we get a chance to see some of that when we're there. But what I want you to know, too, as we get into geography, is just how small a place like Israel is. So if you want to take notes, I'm going to actually be giving away a few things, too. So just hint, hint, if you want to write some of this down, because it'll come back later. But Israel's not very big. So how big do you think the land of Israel is? And if you've been one of my students, you don't get to answer. So how big? Size of Phoenix. A little bit bigger than that. Size of New Jersey. Now we're getting close. So New Jersey sounds good. I'd actually go with that. New Jersey, Massachusetts, those are the right size. It's crazy. I live near the Great Lakes now. Israel is smaller than the Great Lakes. Like when you put it inside of Great Lake. Let me give you a little bit here. The length of Israel, we're talking modern day Israel right now. Okay, so we're not talking biblical, and I'll make the distinction in a second. Modern day Israel is 263 miles long, north to south, in a width between 9 miles to 71 miles at its widest. It is a small, small country. The biblical borders of Israel are actually lengthwise less than that, widthwise a bit longer, a bit wider than that. It's a very small country. God placed his storyline, his people, inside of one location that would end up changing the world. And we're going to get into some conversations on this in the nights as we go forward, but the reason that I believe that God chose that particular area is because it is a trade route that has been the center of trade for all the time that it has existed. Even to this day, Israel is still fought over more than any other place in the world. Natural resource-wise, all the other countries have oil. Israel's sitting there going, why didn't we get any of that? You know, and so natural resource-wise, Israel's not doesn't have natural resources, but it's a place where God put his people, and the trade route runs right through it. So 263 miles long, north to south, 9 miles to 71 miles. And then roughly the size of Massachusetts is like how much territory there is, or the size of Lake Erie. So when you start thinking about what we're used to in California, we're talking about a small, small land. My friend, who's one of my guides, his name's Ronan, he came over to visit me. I actually ended up we named our son after him, one of our sons. So when he was born, he came out to visit baby Ronan. And then he came here to Hume Lake, and then he was going to go to San Diego. And he's like, so how far is it to San Diego? I'm like, oh, probably you get there in 8 hours if you just drive straight through. He like stared at me like I was lying to him. I said, well, it could be longer if there's traffic. And for him, there's no driving like that. Like you can cross the entire country in like 4 hours from top to bottom. So it's very, very small place. You know, because people are going to ask, what would it look like inside of another state? Let me show you. California, we're Californians. You could fit a lot of Israel inside of California. A lot of Israel. Now, I know when I do this, for those of you who are like detail-oriented people, let me just make my disclaimer. It's not to scale. I'm sorry. We can figure that out later. Or you can send me a slide where it is, and then that would be really nice. I'll use it from then on. But there's always somebody in the crowd. Who's from Texas? There's no one from Texas? Every time I teach this, someone's like, but how many would fit inside of Texas? Because they love how big Texas is. So for any Texans who would be here, you could fit a lot of Israels inside of Texas as well. So I just got to try to make people happy. When you look, though, at the land, God places them into a spot, like I said, that is a land bridge between two continents. And that's a strategic reason. Israel will be a place where everyone has to pass through. And so this little tiny nation of Jews, everyone will know the Jewish religion. And then when Jesus comes along, everyone's going to hear about Christianity in a short period of time because of the location where God placed it. Again, God's strategic on what he does. And that's one of the things I love about studying God's word is you sit there and you go, he's got a reason for this. And here it is. Jesus, when he teaches, he's got a reason for going to Caesarea Philippi. Nothing is by accident with the way God works. So this is a little view, a satellite view of Israel and the surrounding areas. And just to give you some modern day geography to look at, we got Israel right here in the center. Now, inside of Israel too, you've heard it from the news, you've got Palestinian territories, there's a whole lot going on. It's kind of, it's complicated. I'll just leave it at that. Always complicated. So you've got Israel here. It's a small country that we just talked about. To the left of Israel is the Mediterranean Sea. So you've got this huge body of water that's right there. To the north of Israel is the country of Lebanon. So you've got Lebanon right up there. To the right of Lebanon and to Israel is Syria. Syria's been in the news like crazy, as you've been just hearing about just the tough stuff going on there and the people who are refugees and all the stuff going on. But Israel's right next to that. To the right of Israel, even in the midsection of it, is the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. Israel has a peace treaty with Jordan right now. It's been a great thing for them. And then to the south is Egypt. So you've got a lot of big countries surrounding this tiny little country called Israel. And in biblical time, it was the same way. You had this territory of the biblical Israel with the tribes, and then you had the big cats and the big dogs, Egypt and Assyria and Syria and like all of these big ones of Babylon that you read about. We always, because of our Christian mindset, place Israel as this big, powerful nation. Israel is a mouse in a cat's world. And it's because of God that they survive and that they prosper, not because of the might of Israel. And we're going to talk through some of that as we move forward in the week. But we got to begin to think Hebrew. Your Bible that we're studying is written to Jewish people, the Hebrew people. We get it, and it's for us as well, definitely. But we've got to begin to start thinking through a Hebrew mindset. And that's one of the fun things I love to do when I was at Joshua. We taught for 9 months straight before we went to Israel, trying to help the students understand a Hebrew perspective of the text so that then they could understand their Christian faith just a little bit more. So a couple of things I'll give you is that words have meaning. When you're reading the Bible and you come across a place, it means something. Like we saw this morning with Caesarea Philippi, there's a meaning behind it. There's reason why the name is there, and it's not just a placeholder of a spot, but there's an actual contextual piece that comes with it. So I'll give you an example here of words having meaning, and we're going to use Bethlehem. So in Hebrew, bet means house, so everybody say bet. And then bread in Hebrew is lechem. So say lechem. If you spit on the person next to you, you're doing really good. So bet lechem is the house of bread. So now you know, like with Bethlehem, when you read that, Bethlehem means the house of bread. Interesting to me that Jesus said he's the bread of life. And he goes into some of these moments where he talks about these things and where was the bread of life born? Ah, Bethlehem, what do you know? It's just fun. The words have meaning and there's reason behind them. Let me give you another one. So we got Bet and Lechem right there for house of bread. Bet Shemesh. So everybody say Bet and say Shemesh. So Bet Shemesh means the house of the sun. And this is a place where a guy by the name of Samson was from. Do you remember Samson? In Hebrew, his name is Shimshon. Shimshon means little sun or little light. And then you've got a lady by the name of Delilah, or Lila in Hebrew is darkness. So you've got a story from a guy from a place that's the house of light, or the house of sun, and his name is Light, and he's going to be dealing with darkness. What do you know in the story? Light mixing with darkness, and he doesn't always do the best job with it. So a Hebrew reader who reads that goes, ooh, that's interesting. Whereas we just read and go, cool, guy's name was Samson from some place called Bet Shemesh or whatever. I love it when people try to pronounce words I'm the same way. You don't get it right, and you just go, who cares, and you move on. But it does mean something. It brings something to the story. Bet Shean, again say Bet Shean. So it means house of security. So if you've never seen this place, if a place is called the house of security, what do you think that this town looks like? Do you think it's built up or do you think it's just like farmland? It's built up with walls on it. So the house of security made them feel secure. So they, in their name, just by saying Bet Shean, we're making a statement of who they were. And so again, Bet Shean's a famous place in the Bible, and if I could show you pictures of it, you'd be like, wow, that place looks pretty cool. And then we'll do a couple names of people. So Elijah's name, he's got the word El at the beginning, so that means it says God. So Elijah's name means Yahweh is God. So remember the whole thing with Elijah versus Baal? And he goes up there. His name already means what he's standing for. Is it Baal or is it God? And he's sitting there going, my name means Yahweh is God. So that's whose side I'm on. He ends up with a little friend that he brings on who ends up not being a little friend, but being a powerhouse of a guy named Elisha. And Elisha's name is El in the beginning, so it means God. It means God saves. So you've got Yahweh is God, and then you've got the Elisha coming on the scene going, hey, Israel, remember, God saves, Yahweh saves. Names mean something. David means beloved. Every time you see a name, just hop on the internet, find a book that has the Hebrew equivalent of the name, and I think you'll be amazed at how the story develops color when you begin to see the names of the people. All right. I love doing this. So here we go. How would you describe God? There's no wrong answer right now. But how would you describe him? Powerful. Great. Holy? What? Beyond comprehension, right? Yeah, what else? Omnipotent. All right, now we got to get some definitions. What does that mean? He's all powerful, right? Yeah. What else? He's patient. Just. Omniscient. Okay, let's define omniscient. All knowing, right? Nice. What? Shepherd. Covenant keeper. Love. Eternal. Omnipresent. Okay, what does that mean? He's always with us, right? You see, we're doing a really simple thing that is known in the Greek way of learning is like defining something. All of your answers that you just gave, no Jewish kid would give except for the one that Jason just gave up here in the front. We like to define God in definition, whereas the Bible defines God in pictures. And so Jason said that God's a shepherd. Well, shepherd's a picture. Like the rest of your answers are not wrong at all. But if you were to close your eyes and I were to sit there and be like, omniscient, all-powerful, and start naming, like, it's hard to come up with an easy picture to that. But the Old Testament is written inside of stories. It's written in a way that people sat around a campfire and grandpa told his kids the stories of the Bible. And so they use pictures to be able to describe that. So let me give you a couple examples of those. And we might jump into a few of those during our time when we're here this week. But God is, and this is what a Jewish person might say if you were to ask a kid, eagle's wings, a rock, God is living water, God is wind, God is a shepherd. You see, they speak in pictures, and we have a saying in English in our Western way of thinking. It says, a picture speaks what? 1,000 words. First thing I tell people when I get them into Israel is I go, my job this week is to give you 1,000 pictures and let that do its thing, and I'll let those speak to you. And so as we get into the Hebrew mindset this week, we got to remember that as we look at things, we got to look at the picture of it. The picture is the important part. Again, Caesarea Philippi talked this morning. It was about the picture of the fact that the kingdom of God, as it will come back, will not be stopped by anything. Not even Caesarea Philippi. Not even anything else. The picture is that God will prevail. And we're going to see that through all these different moments in the Old Testament as we bring them into the New Testament context with Jesus, because when Jesus is teaching, he's still teaching as a Jewish guy to a Jewish audience. And this is the way he'd be teaching it. So we're going to see a lot of this as we move forward. So I'm going to give you one example tonight because I know that it's been a long day, but I want to give one just to get us set up for the rest of the week. And it's what I call the love story. So here we go. And the question is going to be, what is wrong with this picture? And I'm going to give you 2 minutes to talk amongst yourself. It's a picture of the Ten Commandments, in case you can't see it all the way back there. What is the issue with what's wrong with this from a Jewish perspective? And we're going to come up with a lot of thoughts. It's going to be awesome. And then we're going to walk through this together. So take 2 minutes, just kind of think through, you know, from a biblical point of view, maybe from a Jewish point of view, what's wrong with this picture? So you got 2 minutes. I'm going to drink water while you're doing it. Also, as you look at it, I just picked this picture off the internet, so there's no significance that it's by the water. You know the answer. Yeah. All right, let's have some fun with this. What's What things do you want to say about it? Hand up right back there. Yes, Exodus 20 did not exist at the time that the Ten Commandments came down. Bravo, that's a good one. Next. Roman numerals. That would kind of be a slap in the face if you were Jewish to have some Roman numerals on there. Yep, nicely done. They're not broken in pieces. Elaborate on that for me. They were broken in pieces. I like that. I like it. Somebody's been reading. Nice. Okay, we'll play with that in a few minutes. What else? They're written right to left. Yeah, that is right there, very Roman or Greek. Hebrew is right to left rather than left to right. So, all right. It's in English, yes. Yes, it probably would have been in Hebrew. Yeah, that's interesting. We've got two sitting up there. We'll play with that. Any other thoughts?
It wasn't necessarily
viewed as a love story. Yeah. The Jewish people would say it is, but I think from our perspective, it's not necessarily. And we're gonna play with that concept of why they might think that and why we would think of it something different. And that's the fun of looking at the Bible sometimes. Cool. Well, here we go. We're going to play with this. So all of your answers were completely right. Way to go. This is a picture here. It's done again. They weren't, I don't think, going for complete accuracy. I don't think most interpretations or replicas of the Ten Commandments are. But there's going to be a couple of things that are misleading or missing here. And everything you guys said was awesome, so I like it because you're correct on it being in English. You're correct on the reference on there. New Roman numerals, bummer to all of those pieces. So Moses goes, and he's going to get the Ten Commandments. This is the only picture I could find of Moses, and he looks awesome. I mean, if you walk up and down the mountain as many times as he did, you're probably that ripped as well. So, but in Hebrew culture, there are 613 commandments inside of the Old Testament. So from a Hebrew perspective, first off, the Ten Commandments are not special over the 613 that are there together. So if the other 603 aren't as special as these 10, is what they would say. They would say that the Ten Commandments are a covenant, that the Ten Commandments are taking what God desires of us and kind of boiling it down a little bit, but still the 613 are important. So we begin to get this picture from, at least from a Jewish perspective, that the first five books of the Bible are super important. This is the Torah, this is the books of Moses. The 613 commandments are very, very important, and all of a sudden you get this moment where the 10 come out. And for them, they would say that there's a reason for that. For us, as I grew up, it was always like, these are the most important ones. And from a Jewish perspective, they say, no, they're not any more important than the other ones. They're just there to be able to make something called a covenant. So we're going to see that in a second. Exodus 20, if you remember the storyline, Moses is going to go up on the mountain and God's going to tell him the Ten Commandments. The commandments, the other 613, have already been kind of laid out to him. And so he's going to, in the Exodus, Deuteronomy, and some of the other portions of Leviticus, he's going to lay out those 613 commandments. But God gives them to him, and so he orally gives them back to the people. But all of a sudden, in this moment, he gets the Ten Commandments, but it's not for several chapters later that they get written down on tablets. So we're going to walk into that scenario right now. So here we go. We're going to take a look at this. So if you look at chapter 20 of your Bible, it says, and God spoke all these words. Oh, sorry, Exodus. This is where we're at. Exodus 20. And God spoke all of these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything on heaven above or on earth below or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. And he goes on to lay out his expectations for the Israelites. This is before the tablets exist. And Moses comes down, and we know from reading scripture that he tells the people, and the people are like, okay, we got to figure this out. We got to figure out how to learn in this, to live in this relationship, this covenant with God. So what we're going to get in verse, if you turn with me over to chapter 32, this is where we're going to see the covenant actually come down. So we've got the rules for the covenant, but God's going to do the covenant with Moses. So the first thing we've got to kind of deal with is, what is a covenant? Now, for us, as we read it, covenants don't make sense because we don't do too many of those today. But in the old time of the Old Testament, covenants were done all the time. This was the legal binding of how a transaction was made. And so we are going to see a moment in history where Abraham has a covenant with God. God doesn't explain to him what to do. Abraham just knows because it's part of his culture of what he does. Same thing here with Moses. When he goes up on top of Mount Sinai, he's going to go up and he's going to partake in an event that is normal to the culture that he lives in, which is that of making a covenant. So we're going to see that in a covenant, the higher authority always sets up the conditions. So Exodus 20 verse 1 says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of slavery in Egypt. I'm the higher authority as God. You're the lower authority. Remember what I did for you. Here's the covenant of what it's going to be like to be in relationship with me. And so he's going to lay that out. Now, we're going to see a couple things happen here with this covenant, is that Moses is going to go up on a hill and spend some time with God. And it says this, when the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down, so Moses has been up on top of the hill for a while, that they gathered around, this is chapter 32, they gathered around the mountain and they found Aaron and said, come make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses, I love how he's gone from their leader to now a fellow. This fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. Aaron, who's his brother and best buddy, answered them, take off those gold earrings that your wives have and your sons and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me so that the people, so that we can have them. So the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron, and he took them and handed them to him, and he made an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then he said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And so we've got a good moment now with our good buddy Aaron, who is setting up pagan idolatry for them. Remember, in chapter 20, which is earlier on already, they've already heard that they're not to have any gods before God. They came from a land in Egypt that did this. And so God clearly states it to them that they shouldn't be doing this. But yet, they go and do it anyway. So we're going to need to deal with that fact right now of what it means, the fact that Moses is going to go up there. So Moses has been up on top of the mountain, and it says that Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. So how many tablets are there when Moses comes down? Two, right? Is there writing on front and back or just on the front? Front and back. So our picture that we had was really convenient for taking a photo. It's got half of them on one, half of them on the other. But what we're getting here inside of this covenant move is that Moses goes up on top of Mount Sinai with God, and God's up there and says, God says to Moses, I am the God who brought you out. So here's the covenant that I'm going to make with you, Moses. Here are the rules that are going to sum it up inside of the things I need you to do. I've already told them to you before. Now we're going to put them on tablets. And so God inscribes two tablets front and back. So we've got one that's got the Ten Commandments on it, and then we have another one that has the Ten Commandments on it. And so the question is, why? So covenant-wise, if you were with the covenant and the lesser party broke the covenant, it was void. It was over. And so God's setting up this thing. So let me give you just a little example from my Joshua days. So in Joshua, when the Joshua students would come to our program, we would have them do crazy things like saying, hey, for the next year, you're not going to watch movies, you can't watch TV, you can't listen to music, you can't date. I mean, it sounds like a horrible place to be. You can't do any of these things. So if you want to be in the program, these are the rules that you got to commit to. And I sit there and I go, I am rich, I am the director of this program. If you say that you will do these things, I will give you all the benefits and all that comes with the Joshua program. If you don't do these things, you're no longer in the program. And so there is a piece of paper that has all of those rules I just stated on them, and there's a place for me to sign, and there's a place for the student to sign. And there's two copies of it. I take my copy back to my most special place, which was my office filing cabinet. Put it right in there. And the student takes their copy back to their most special place, which was somewhere in their room. We always encourage them to put it up on their cork board so they could see it and remember what they were committing to. You see, the way this worked is if a student ever broke the covenant, and I knew about it, I would come to the room, knock on the door, and be like, hey, please give me your covenant. And they would give me their covenant. They'd come back to my office. We would talk. And if I ripped that covenant up, I was no longer bound to keep them in the program, and they were finished. There were many a days where I'd be sitting in my office, and I'd hear a student walks in with their covenant, Rich, I broke it. And they'd hand it to me, and they'd give it to me, because at that point, I was no longer bound to keep them in the program because they had broken the covenant. So we get this incredible moment up on top of Mount Sinai where God's up there with Moses. He goes, Moses, here's what I expect of you. Here's what I want for the people. Here's what I want them to do. I've made two tablets, Moses. And Moses takes his. And God says, Moses, my most special place is wherever you are. Take my copy. So all of a sudden, Moses leaves the top of Mount Sinai carrying two copies of the testimony of the covenant. And he begins to bring them down the mountain. And I can only imagine his feeling of going, God did not have to do this, but what he's done is he says that he, his most special place is wherever we are. And so Moses begins to make his way down from the top of the mountain. And he says this, Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands. I'm in chapter 32, verse 13. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God, engraved on both tablets. When Joshua, who is waiting down below, heard the noise of the people shouting, he meets up with Moses. And there, and he says to Moses, there's a sound of war in the camp. Moses replied, and it's not the sound of victory. It's not the sound of defeat. It's not the sound of war. It's the sound of singing I hear. And so Moses approaches, and something's going on in the camp. And then he makes his way down. And when Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned, and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them to pieces at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf that they had made, and he burned it, and he's going to make them drink it and do all these different things. But Moses realizes in this moment that that's covenant between him and God that God had made with him and the people was done. They've already broken it. They're already worshiping idols and they're making idols out of things. And so he breaks it on the ground going, we're done. We're finished. So now we've got broken, destroyed tablets. And you know, that could be the end of the story. But as you guys know, it's not. Chapter 34, we get this interlude of things that happen in between. You're more than welcome to read it if you'd like when you have some time. The Lord said to Moses, chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready in the morning, and then come up on the Mount Sinai. Present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. No one is to come with you or be seen anywhere near the mountain. Not even the flocks and herds may graze in front of the mountain. So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones and went up on the mountain Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the two tablets in his hands. Then the Lord came down in a cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abiding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to the thousands and forgiving wickedness and rebellion and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. I don't know about you, but if I'm sitting there with God and he starts talking about all of that, you're like, we're done. Like, what's he going to do this time as far as the covenant with us? Because this isn't sounding good. But I love this. Moses is so Jewish. It's so great. Moses bowed to the ground. We see Abraham doing the same thing when God's like, hey, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And he's like, yeah, what if there's 50 good people? Okay, I won't destroy it. What if there's 25? You know, like he negotiates God down and it's fantastic because he has chutzpah. He's like willing to have a conversation with God. Moses does the same thing. Moses bowed to the ground at once and worshiped. Oh Lord, if I have found favor in your eyes, he said, then let the Lord go with us. Although this is a stiff-necked people, forgive us of our wickedness and our sin and take us as your inheritance. Rewrite the covenant. Be with us. Then the Lord said, I'm making a covenant with you before all of your people. I will do wonders never before seen. And he goes on to talk about the people and the land and the different parts of it. And then all of a sudden, we get this moment where we don't know the outcome of what's going to happen, but God seems to be sitting there going, Moses, I still choose you guys. And then verse 29, when Moses came down from the Mount Sinai, he came down with one or two tablets in his hands. Two tablets in his hands. And it says he was not aware of the radiance of his face because he'd been with the Lord. Moses makes his way down and God gives him both. He's going to take those two tablets and he's going to put them in the Ark of the Covenant. And if you know the story, which is so awesome, of the Ark of the Covenant, where does God reside? Wherever that Ark of the Covenant is. Wherever those tablets are, God's glory is there. And so the tabernacle is set up, the Ark of the Covenant is set forth, and God's glory rests in that place. Because he said, Moses, I make this covenant with you and your people, the Israelites, but my most special place is with you, because I'm not a God of distance. I'm a God who's right here with you, in the middle of the camp, with you all the time. If you want to find me, go to where you're keeping your most special things. That's where I'll be. And so the Ark of the Covenant is special because it's got the words of God on it, but it's got God's copy too, and God's making the statement that this is my home. Lots happens in the history of Israel, as you know. They move through the desert, a generation dies, they finally come into the land, they don't always do it the best way that they should. They finally get into a spot where, we're learning about it right now, they want a king, right? And God gives them a king in the midst of them asking for something that they probably shouldn't have asked for. And the kings are going to change things up. Instead of it being God residing right there inside of a tent that moves around wherever the people are, the kings are going to build things. They're going to build palaces. They're going to build places of worship. And before we know it, we're going to have a moment where God now is sitting at a place called the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Small backstory as we finish this off. Abraham, in the storyline, God tells Abraham, go on a 3-day journey and take your son Isaac. Abraham's name means exalted father. Actually, when it's Abram, it means that. When he becomes Abraham, it means exalted father of many, but the guy's got no kids. God gives him Isaac. Isaac's name means laughter or life. And God says, take laughter or life, your only son, and take him to sacrifice him on a hill that I'm going to tell you. He takes him to a place called Mount Moriah. He goes there to kill his son. God intervenes, a ram shows up, he does the ram instead. A guy named David is going to purchase a threshing floor on the top of a mountain called Mount Moriah. Solomon will build a temple on top of Mount Moriah, and the sacrificial system will begin. And all of a sudden, a guy by the name of Jesus Christ will be taken to be killed on top of a mountain called Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. And when he is killed, it will change everything. God was sitting inside the temple on top of the box that was called the Ark of the Covenant. If you want to find me, that's where I'll be. And then all of a sudden, Christ dies on the cross. And it says that the veil of the temple rips in half, separating the Holy of Holies from the priests. And I used to always sit there and be like, it ripped so that we could go in. But that's not the truth anymore as I look at it. It ripped because God left. No longer was he to be found sitting on top of the Holy of Holies box inside of this space where the Ark of the Covenant was. No, he was coming out to change it up. When Christ dies on the cross, the atonement for sin is finally taken care of. In less than 50 days from that moment, time called Pentecost happens, where God begins to dwell inside of his people. One of my favorite stories is going to the Temple Mount complex. And I'm sitting there with one of my students. His name was Ben. He was just a crazy guy. And he was really passionate. And he goes up there and he's at the Wailing Wall and he's like praying. And he comes back and, well, Ben, how was it? And he's like, Rich, that was horrible. Well, why? You're a passionate guy. I thought you would love that. He's like, no, they're praying their hearts out, Rich, but God's not there. They're praying their hearts out to this location where God one time used to be, but he's not there. And I looked at him, oh, Ben, you're so wrong. They're praying their hearts out and they were in the presence of God because you were standing next to him and God lives in you. He's like, oh. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, that's the gospel story. That's the story that I desire all my Jewish friends to know, is that God comes out and he indwells inside of his people. The love story is that God's never been a God who's far removed from his people. From the very beginning of the covenant was a storyline of I am with you, all the way to the point where Jesus dies on the cross. And I always tell students and people, I take them usually when we're in the Bethlehem area to an old cave. It's all gross and disgusting. And they're sitting there and I'm like, I don't can't tell you exactly where Jesus was born, but I can tell you this, it doesn't really matter. The God of the universe, who was willing to come down and be born in something that might have been substandard potentially, that's just the kind of guy he was. That's just the kind of God he is, because what? He's willing to live in this. So who cares what he was born into? He's willing to live inside of somebody who's a sinner as wretched as anybody else. Because God's he's in the business of changing lives. He's in the business of redemption. And he always has been. And that for me is the story of the Ten Commandments. Are they important? You bet they are. Should we live by them? Yes. I want my children to live by the Ten Commandments. Especially that little one about honoring your parents. That's a good one. But it's a bigger piece that shows a love story of God's covenant relationship. And I love sitting with my Jewish friends who sit there and they go, this is a love story of God coming down. And I go, yes, how do I connect you to the rest of the love story? And that's the part that I'm always passionate about with them. So as we think Hebrew the rest of this week, we're going to look at Jesus in the context of the first century in a Jewish world, but we're going to look at what he does and how he interacts with it. We're going to look at the culture and how that plays into it. We're going to look at probably some of the same stories you've seen a bunch of different times, but hopefully maybe they'll bring a little bit of color to them. But my hope is that during our time together, we will love Jesus deeply, that we'll know him better, and then we'll be excited to continue to read our Bibles because it's so rich, it's so full, and it's what's going to help us grow. So finishing off really quick before I give you a quiz to give away a couple things. I'm going to teach you some Hebrew. So you all need to be able to read this. Right to left, no big deal. We got this. Those little things are called nikud that are underneath it. We got no problem. Also, there's no vowels. So you're just going to have to make them up as you go. But this is the Shema. It comes out of Deuteronomy 6. And Jesus, when being tempted by Satan multiple times, runs right back to this verse. And he uses Deuteronomy multiple times in his time with Satan. And the Jewish people memorize the Shema as a prayer. And a lot of times they'll sing it, and it's really beautiful. I'm not a good singer, so we're just going to learn how to say it. And I'm going to give it to you in English. So, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. That's why you'll see Jewish people tie things on their hands. And bind them on your foreheads. You'll sometimes see that on your foreheads. And write them on the door frames of your house and on your gates. And when you walk into Israel places or Jewish places, you'll see things on people's door frames as well, called mezuzahs. But this is the whole concept for them, is that you live out your faith in all that you do and you teach it to your kids. And I think for us as Christians, this is what we probably desire most of our children, is how do I teach my children to know God and to love him all the more? So for my wife and I, this has been a life verse for us, is training our kids to know these things about God. So hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So there's only one God. Again, Caesarea Philippi, remember? Lots of gods, one God. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. So you ready to tackle a piece of it in Hebrew? Wrote it in English transliteration for you, so it's a little bit easier. So just repeat after me. Shema Israel. Adonai Eloheinu. Adonai Echad. Oh, you're pros. So try it again. Shema Israel. Adonai Eloheinu. Adonai Echad. And what you just said was, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You know, and if that's something that we can just remember, like one God, that's what matters. I think that's a good thing for us. And if you come the rest of the week, I'll teach you the rest of it if you want to know it. I've got some cards up here that have it on it if you like want to kind of practice it. Sometimes it's fun to learn another language. But what's more important is just knowing there's only one God and that we're to love him with all of who we are. So we're going to have some fun the rest of the week. Again, we're going to have some maps for you to do if you want to. We're going to talk through locations. I'm going to do my best to take you to Israel without taking you to Israel. So that's kind of my goal for the rest of the time. So here comes a couple questions really quick to give away a few things. I wrote a few down, hoping I'd remember. So the first thing I'm going to give away is a nice little journal. So maybe you could take notes this week or do something else with it. Shameless plug, my company is on here, sorry. All right, here comes the question. What does Bethlehem mean? Oh, hand up right there. What? Come on up right here. It's yours. Got a couple more? Don't worry, they're not as cool. If you can win this, then you'll have a pen to go with it. couple of pins, so we'll do a couple more. How many commandments are there besides the 10? How many altogether? Whoa, whoa, which? 613, right on. Here it comes. Sorry. All right, here comes another one. What does the name Elijah mean? You got to raise your hand. Right back there. Come on up. And let's do, how long is the modern state of Israel today? 263. There it is. Nicely done. A couple other things I just wanted to share with you guys as we finish up. In the back, what we do as a company is we train pastors to take their churches to Israel. It's the coolest thing to be able to take pastors over, show them the land so that they can then, if maybe in the future, take their congregation and lead them through the land. It's so much fun. But every year we do two trips. We do one to Turkey and one to Israel, where we take anybody who's in ministry and we underwrite the cost. Because we know that if someone in ministry gets a chance to go, they'll then use that and put that back into the people around them. So if you know of anybody in ministry, it can be in youth ministry, it can be a worship pastor, it can be a senior pastor, it can be anyone who's doing full-time ministry, a typical trip to Turkey or to Israel out of Los Angeles costs about $4,000. We underwrite it to $2,800. So we just like to do that as a company once a year to people in ministry. So I put some of these in the back. So if you know people who that might be a blessing to them, and maybe you fall into that category too, so that'd be awesome. Feel free to take one of these and just tell them, hey, love to see you get a chance to go. I still know that's a lot of money, but it's a lot cheaper, and hopefully it's more doable for people who are given so much in ministry. So we just wanted to let people know about that. And then I'll be around all week. If you ever want to talk Israel, all you got to say is, Rich, let's talk Israel. And then my wife will be like, well, there he goes. We won't be able to, he's gone. But I'd love to just meet with people and chat about anything related to that. And then starting tomorrow, I'll do Q&As at the end with anything that we're teaching on, because tomorrow we'll actually do some teachings and then go, hey, what do you think about this? Because half the fun of going to the land is being with people and going, you've read this story 100 times. What stands out now? And then someone will say something, I'll be like, I never thought of that. That's awesome. You know, so it's as much for me as it is for you guys. So let me pray for you, and then we will get you out of here. Tried to get you done by 8, but I'm a little bit over, so I'm sorry.